Are you ready to become a better version of yourself, to become a leader in your personal and professional life? Then welcome to the CJ Evolution Podcast, where we put a twist on traditional criminal justice professions and provide you with the tools you need to set yourself up for success in your career and for the future. Now, welcome your host, the CJ Evolutionist himself, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Episode 237 of the CJ Evolution Podcast. My name is Pat Fitzgibbons. I'm the host and creator of this great and growing show, growing because of you, the listener and supporter. Thank you so much for tuning in. I know you have many options out there, literally hundreds of thousands probably, of podcasts out there. Thank you for spending a little bit of your valuable time with me. Special thanks to all those first responders out there, brave men and women who work in a very difficult environment. Every day, they're putting it on the line to protect this great country. Thank you so much for what you do. Keep up the fantastic work. You all know I am partnered with Four Sigmatic, a great coffee company that continues to grow by leaps and bounds. They have amazing products, most notably their mushroom coffee. I'm a big fan of the lion's mane coffee. Lion's mane is a type of mushroom, and it doesn't taste like mushrooms, like I've indicated before. It's great. You're going to love it. If you head over to cjevolution.com, you're going to see a link for this great company. Click it. Go see what they can do for you. See all the great products, and you will get 15% off using promo code CJEVO. You know, folks, I have been blessed and honored to have so many guests on the show in the last couple of years. Truly amazing guests, all of them, talking about a variety of topics and issues and how to overcome obstacles in your life. My next guest, this guy's going to keep you on the edge of your seat. Not only is he an amazing guest, he is a true American hero. And not so long ago, him and his partner were fighting for their lives on a highway in Mexico, protecting this great country we call the United States. Stay tuned for this powerful episode, sad episode, but an episode that's going to keep you engaged and on the edge of your seat. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I'm very excited to have Victor Avila on the show. If you don't know who Victor is, he's a retired Homeland Security special agent, and his story is amazing. And I'm going to let him tell the story. Victor, you there, sir?
I'm here. Thanks for having me on, Patrick.
Well, thank you so much. I know you're busy. I know you got a lot going on. You know, your story is incredible. You're still fighting a fight. But I want to before we get into your story on that fateful day. What made you get into law enforcement, brother? What made you want to do what you did?
My mom always tells me that I wanted to be a police officer since I was a little kid. Mm-hmm. But I remember being a police explorer as I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And that's what started my my interest in law enforcement, right along with police officers and getting to see what they did, other than what you saw on TV, which I thought was very important to really know. Yeah. what the job meant. I just continued on. I went to school, and when I was in college, that just led me to the way to get a criminal justice degree. Mm-hmm. And I eventually started off with the state system. Mm-hmm. As a state parole officer for the state of Texas, and you know, dealing with the offenders, that these parolees that get released from prison. And you know, I learned that people that go to prison don't stay in prison forever. most of them, they do get released.
Yeah, they do.
And they're back in the community. And I happen to supervise the worst of the worst. They called it back then the super intensive supervision program. Mm-hmm. So I dealt with that for 3 years or so, and then moved up to the federal system. I've been an ambitious person and moved up to the what they call U.S. probation. Mm-hmm. Under the U.S. courts. And that's really what paved my way to become a criminal investigator, a special agent. Mm-hmm. Because I dealt with criminal investigators from every agency, FBI, DEA, U.S. Marshals, INS back then, U.S. Customs, and writing these pre-sentence reports. And eventually, I didn't want to write the reports. I wanted to be that person that completed these investigations, and that's what led my way. And back then it was a U.S. Customs Service that I applied for, and that's when the merger occurred between the U.S. Customs Special Agents and the Immigration and Naturalization Service Special Agents. The criminal investigators merged. Mm-hmm. To form what we know now as ICE. Mm-hmm. So I happened to be one of those from the very beginning of the merger. I actually graduated with U.S. Customs Special Agent credentials because they hadn't invented the ice badge yet.
Yeah.
So that was one of those. I went through the growing pains of the new Homeland Security agency.
Yeah, and ICE. I think there's a lot of bad press out there, and you know that, Victor, for about ICE. But I mean, they do a great job and a much needed job for this country.
You know, ICE, just because it's known as a new name, but immigration has always existed here. The immigration laws are still the same ones. Mm-hmm. It was the Immigration and Naturalization Service. It's still the same thing. Now, within ICE, they kind of just created two divisions, the ERO, the Enforcement Removal Operations, and where I worked as HSI, Homeland Security Investigations, or the Criminal Investigators. And they both form under the umbrella of ICE and under the bigger umbrella of the Department of Homeland Security.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your service, sir. Can we talk about this fateful day on a highway in Mexico on February 15th, 2011? A story for those listeners out there that rocked the nation all the way up to the highest levels.
Absolutely, it did. I was assigned to the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City back in 2009, and that's the hardest and the most I've ever worked in my life. Mm-hmm. It was a very rewarding job, and I really thoroughly enjoyed it. I love being in Mexico. Being a first-generation Mexican-American, I love going back and actually learning more of the culture that I thought that I knew, but it really I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different, even being a Mexican-American. So I took my family. It was a great station, a lot of work. I hardly got to see my family because I was involved in heavily in my work duties. But fast forward to 2011, this assignment came on February 14th, on Valentine's Day of 2011. I had just actually returned back to Mexico. I was in, believe it or not, I was in Colorado conducting an investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And had just returned back and was very prepared to be in that office the whole week to conduct a lot of my administrative duties. But about noon, I got a heads up from one of my coworkers saying, hey, it looks like they're going to send you to Monterey to go meet up with our ICE agents from the U.S. consulate in Monterey for some pickup of some equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And I jumped the gun.
You didn't want to do that. You were like, no.
No, I did not. I'm not a shy person. And mm-hmm. I eventually vocalized my, my unwillingness to do this assignment and why me. There's other agents in this office. I just got in. What's going on? Mm-hmm. But after lunch in Mexico around 3 o'clock, the official assignment from my supervisor came and said, listen, we want you. And they referred to Jaime Zapata, Special Agent Jaime Zapata, as a TD wire because he was a temporary duty agent assigned to the office. I think he had been there a little over a week. And he's going to accompany you to go pick up this equipment. You're going to meet our co-workers, counterparts in Monterey and make arrangements to pick up this equipment.
Mm-hmm.
I had nothing really to do with this investigation, this equipment. It was someone else's investigation. It was a big investigation that dealt with money laundering. And our supervisors were very anxious to have that equipment in Mexico. Apparently, there was going to be a big operation that was going to be conducted, and they needed these transmitters and tracking trackers and other kind of mm-hmm. surveillance type equipment immediately. They wanted it there by the close of business day on February 15th, the following day. But if you know, from Mexico City to Monterey, it's an 11-hour drive.
Mm-hmm.
So I made arrangements with the assistant attaché, the ICE assistant attaché, to meet him halfway. And we ended up making arrangements to meet. For me, it was about a 5.5-hour drive, more or less, close to 6 hours. And going back on Valentine's Day, I met Jaime Zapata.
Mm-hmm.
He was introduced to me. We exchanged phone numbers and radio contact. We used a lot of phone radio back then, Nextels.
Mm-hmm.
We exchanged it, and I said, you need to be in my apartment. I lived in the northern part of the city, and, for me to avoid coming down and fighting this traffic in the morning, you have to go to my apartment, and we'll go from there. Another agent volunteered to take him to me my home at 6:30 in the morning the following day, which he did. Jaime showed up there at 6:30. We get in my Arbor Suburban. Arbor Suburban is a vehicle that I was issued. We drove as a daily driver every day. They were fairly brand new vehicles. We had picked them up in September of the previous year. And here we go. Here we off. Jaime and I, I'm driving, and we head north on Highway 57. Highway 57 is just like an American. They call it a highway, but it really is not a highway. It's a freeway. It's an interstate. It's the toll road. It's the safe road. It's the nice road. It's the nice paved road. Mm-hmm. It's a two-lane highway going, two lanes going north, two lanes going south, separated by a median. And we head north, and we were driving, and Jaime and I have this great conversation. I'd never met Jaime before.
Mm-hmm. But you just clicked.
We hit it off. I felt I knew him all my life.
Yeah.
And he reminded me a lot of me. Mm-hmm. He was also a border agent. And worked the cases that, like, I worked the cases. Right away, I knew. He got phone calls on his work phone about some smuggling ventures that was going on, and investigations. And I knew he was a working agent like me. And he was aspiring to eventually get assigned to a permanent position there in Mexico City. Mm-hmm. And so we talked a lot. He shared a lot of personal stories about him and back then his fiance. And really, there was never an awkward moment or a silent moment. We were just on a continuous conversation, which is great memories for me. Mm-hmm. We then continued driving. Eventually, about 11:30 a.m., we made contact with the other ICE agents right on kilometer 100, which is on the side of the Highway 57. There's a small restaurant there, and we exchanged this equipment. Now, this equipment is in big boxes, small boxes, medium-sized boxes. Mm-hmm. And we transfer them from one Suburban to the other, and we end up folding not just the third row seat, but also the second row seats in order for all the boxes to fit in the cargo area. And that's important because, you know, it limited us from jumping to the back. And when I tell you the story, you'll know.
Yeah.
we were just contained to the front cabin, the front two seats of the Suburban. So we do the exchange, and I had asked Jaime if he wanted to grab something to eat real quick there at that restaurant. No, he had seen a Subway that's on the way to. He was very surprised to see a Subway in Mexico, and he wanted Subway. I said we could stop at Subway on the way back, and so we did. I'm still driving. Now we're driving south back to Mexico City. We're probably at that point about a good 7 hours out. And we drive. We're driving. I'm still driving. And the first thing we notice is this Mexican federal police officer in the median by himself in a MARC unit. He's in uniform outside of his car with an M4 kind of, you know, checking out traffic and kind of scoping traffic left to right, right to left, right to left. Mm-hmm. And, you know, traffic is kind of slowing down. This is not a checkpoint. This is not a...
So it's odd.
It's very... Oh, no, I've been through many military checkpoints and police checkpoints in Mexico, legal and illegal, and you kind of learn how to go through them and identify yourself. This wasn't it. This was just a guy there, this police officer just there, and we pass by. Everybody kind of slows down, look at him. He's looking at us, and I tell Jaime, man, what the hell is this guy doing? This is awkward. And I said, are you scared? He says, yeah. I said, yeah, me too, man. I don't know what the heck this guy, a little bit more profanity that I don't speak. I speak a little bit more.
And you guys are armed, right, Victor? You're armed.
We are. So. Okay. And I'm glad you brought that point up because I had two sidearms. I had a Glock 19 and a SIG in my backpack. Mm-hmm. And I usually put my backpack when I'm driving right behind me on the floorboard of the back seat. For easy access. When we lowered the seats, the guns and the backpack and everything was
inaccessible.
It was not accessible at that point. And I did tell Jaime when we were driving, when we had just started driving on our first pit stop to gas up. I told him, oh, by the way, I have these two issued handguns here. If the shit hits the fan, I actually told him that. Sorry about that, but that's how I told him.
No, that's fine.
Never thinking in my wildest that we would ever encounter something that we were about to that day. So we stop at the Subway. We have a great lunch. This is about 1:30 p.m. It was a beautiful day. I remember telling Jaime, this is one of the things you want to come down here for the weather. It's very very San Diego-like weather. Mm-hmm. It's 72 degrees on February 15th. You know, it's great. And now we're going to, you know, we're heading back after lunch, and I throw him the keys, and I said, you go ahead and drive. And also to get him familiar with the Suburban, he had never driven an armored vehicle before. Mm-hmm. And this vehicle weighs almost 6 tons. And it's not the same as driving a normal vehicle. You need a acceleration times a lot more, braking distance is a lot more. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, it's a best place to kind of practice is on the open road. And so he starts driving. I had a lot of work to do on my BlackBerry back then. I was preparing a human trafficking conference in Ciudad Juarez and a bunch of other stuff going on. And so I took the time to start making phone calls and emails and all that. And so we're driving. I call my supervisor. I tell him now we're about 5 hours out, more or less. We'll be coming into the city. And we're not, you know, they didn't say we want to don't come straight to the embassy. They just said, you know, okay, well, you know, wait for you when you get here. I told Jaime when we get into Mexico City, I would take the wheel because rush hour in Mexico City is between 7 and 9 p.m. And it's just chaotic, as you can imagine, the traffic over there. So I told him, I'll take it. Once you get in there, I'll take the wheel. Mm-hmm. And within, I guess, after about 15 minutes of driving, Jaime is the one that alerts me. Two SUVs passes at a high rate of speed right next to us. We're on the far right lane. And he says, hey, that SUV that just passes, the second one, it looks like it's a long gun sticking out of the back seat. And I look up, and sure enough, that's some kind of a rifle. And I just tell him, let him go, let him be. They were going, 90 miles an hour, really fast. Mm-hmm. We're going about 70, 72. And so much that we kind of see him, off in the distance, almost losing complete sight of them. But before you knew it, we were right on top of them. Mm-hmm. They had reduced their speed dramatically. Mm-hmm. And we were up on them, and one of the SUVs gets right next to us, mirror to mirror. They roll down their windows and they bring out AK-47s and start ordering us to pull over. And it is all in Spanish, by the way. Mm-hmm. I tell Jaime, go. Jaime steps on it, tries to evade him a little bit. They come back, and now a front SUV, a second SUV, and the one next to us start blocking us in, almost to the point of contact and crashing us. And they force us off the road, and Jaime pulls over to the right side of the shoulder of the highway, and we stop immediately. About 8 to 10 armed individuals get out.
Jesus.
They semi-circle the front of the Suburban with AK-47s and handguns and rifles and everything you can imagine there. And mm-hmm. one of them immediately comes to Jaime's door and opens the door. Completely wide open. The Suburban had unlocked mm-hmm. when Jaime placed the vehicle in park.
So it had like some sort of mechanism to unlock it.
Correct. It was programmed that way.
Okay.
And there's other issues that we had with the Suburban as far as equipment. The mm-hmm. siren didn't work. The PA system didn't work. It hadn't been working for months.
Mm-hmm.
And so immediately Jaime, as soon as he swings the door open, Jaime grabs his handle and swings the door shut. We start hitting the lock buttons, and they're yanking at the doors, ordering us to get out. And we're not getting out. We have our hands up, plain sight, right almost up against the windshield. And then eventually the guy that opened the door, he's the one kind of taking in command of the whole scene. And he then shoots a couple of rounds towards the front driver's door, Jaime's door, or front tire area. And that's the first time we're like, well, did he just shoot at the door? It's kind of unreal and overwhelming when it's happening. And I'm yelling at them. I'm telling them we're Americans. Mm-hmm. We're U.S. Embassy employees. We're U.S. diplomats. This is a diplomatic vehicle. We are not who you think we are. You're mistaking us for someone else. The vehicles are identified by specific diplomatic plates.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just screaming at the top of my lungs, trying to get them to know that it was in us, that trying to identify us. And I wanted to show my diplomatic passport, but it was actually caught with the weapons underneath in the backpack.
Hmm.
So before you know it, they two of the shooters come to my right side, right at my door window, and they introduce an AK-47 barrel and a handgun barrel. The window on my side had lowered about 2 inches when we hit the lock buttons. We inadvertently hit the...
I was going to say, so all the panic probably, like you said, you probably... We
lowered that window without knowing.
Yeah, yeah.
And this whole commotion, you know, our hands are up. I'm yelling at them. All of a sudden, boom, they're there. I immediately raise the button to raise the window, and it catches both barrels of both guns.
Oh, geez.
And they're struggling with the, they're pushing it up, you know, and especially the guy with the AK-47 is pushing the barrel down and the butt of the gun up. And without warning, they open fire. And immediately Jaime yells, "I'm hit." I tell him, "Go, go, 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 go." I'm kind of post up against the vehicle, the post by my seat, just trying to avoid getting hit in the head, because they shot right by my left ear. And I see Jaime get hit on his side and his torso, and he's not responding. So I get the handle, the shift lever, and I slam it down, and I put my hand on his leg and hit the gas, and we crash the SUV in front of us. And where I'm trying to get the SUV back on Highway 57, our suburban, and it kind of does that, but immediately then just kind of drives into the median. Jaime at that point has become unresponsive, and the suburban ends up in the median. I grab the steering wheel, try to put the vehicle back up on Highway 57, and that's where it ended up. And you'll see the pictures on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So, I noticed that, you know, Jaime had been shot in the leg at that point. He's, you know, bleeding profusely.
You've been shot too, Victor.
I had no idea I had been shot at that point. I had no clue. I get one of my phones and it doesn't work. The radio phone doesn't work. I pick up my BlackBerry and I call the U.S. Embassy. And this call is, you probably can hear it now online.
Mm.
I actually just heard it for the first time just last year during the trial.
Mm.
But it's about a 20-second phone call where I call in and I tell them that we're shot. I identify myself as Victor Avila, a special agent with ICE, to please call my supervisor, Jerry Miles. And then they transfer the call to the regional security office, which is the diplomatic security special agents and the security for the embassy. The receptionist answers the phone, and I'm yelling at the top of my lungs, and she drops the phone and runs down the hallway saying Victor Avila has been shot. My wife is 5 feet away. She happens to work there.
Mm-hmm.
And she comes out of the office and says, "What? What did you just say?" And Victor Avila has been shot. And my wife goes into this, you know, chaotic state. And,
of course. Yeah.
A diplomatic security special agent, a friend of mine, gets on the phone. And I'm telling him, we need help. We've been shot at. And we're on Highway 57. I don't know at that point exactly our location. I know we're on the highway. I don't know exactly the kilometer marker.
So these thugs, these murder, they take off. I'm assuming that they're are they still trying to get to you, Victor, or have they gone already?
When I thought they were both gone.
Mm-hmm.
When they pulled the guns out of the cabin of the Suburban, and I raised the window, they shot up the whole side there. They found over 90 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
That were shot at the Suburban. And then I couldn't see a lot from the right side because these armored vehicles, when you shoot them, the glass turns to some kind of snow like effect, which you can't see through.
Mm-hmm.
But while I'm trying to, you know, get on the phone and all that, one of the SUVs, one of the shooters, I see him leaving, you know, driving south on the Highway 57, but then makes a U-turn, comes right back and parks right in front of the Suburban. And two guys get out with AK-47s and they look at me. They're standing right in front of the hood of the Suburban. And I'm looking at them and they just open fire. And they're just spraying with bullets the front windshield of the Suburban. And at that point, I was kind of frozen and not realizing that the bullets are not coming in. And kind of now you know, I went through all the fight, the flight, you know, and the freeze states.
Yeah.
And that was my freeze state right there.
Mm.
They then turn around, get in their SUV and take off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started making the phone calls and all that. And Eventually on the phone, an ICE agent gets on there, a special agent from ICE, a friend of mine. We were at the academy together, gets on the phone, and he's the one that first tells me, have you been shot? Check yourself. And I did. That's when the first time I was bleeding profusely from my chest. And then I noticed my leg. And so he tells me, take off your belt and you know, build a tourniquet and put it all the way up your leg. I did. I was feeling it. And I noticed the gun, the wound to my chest, and obviously the one to my leg. The second one to my leg, I didn't know that until I got to the hospital, that I've been shot down in my lower part of my leg. But I'm checking on Jaime. Jaime's unresponsive. Mm-hmm. I'm shaking him. At some point, I'm really being aggressive with him. I want him to be awake. And some of that I did is during the phone call. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to determine where I'm at. During that whole commotion, all of a sudden what appears to be an ambulance show up on the side of the road. And this one quote unquote paramedic comes out and approaches a Suburban on my side. And he's telling me to open the door. And I have, you know, at this point, I don't trust anyone there.
Exactly.
I don't know who the heck is this person. Yeah, yeah. And I found out during the trial that ambulance was the Zeta cartels that had attacked us. It's their ambulance. Mm-hmm. They even have an ambulance that follows them when they get in these shootouts. Jeez. To rescue them. That's how organized these drug organizations and terrorist organizations are in Mexico. Mm-hmm. They're not gangs, street gangs, as some people want you to believe. They're highly organized criminals and violent, very violent. So these Zeta cartels that, you know, I hadn't mentioned who they were, but that's who they were, the Zeta cartels. And mm-hmm. they owned that whole area of Mexico at that time. We knew it. I mean, I talked to my counterpart in Monterey, and he's like, he even said, listen, there's a lot of what he calls scrimmages going on between the cartels and the Mexican military and police. Mm-hmm. We get the intelligence every day. And so it was very disheartening that we still had to be placed in that situation. But mm-hmm. eventually I get on the phone with a Mexican federal police, the head of our vetted unit that we work with on a daily basis in Mexico. He answered the phone. I get with him. He deploys a helicopter, and eventually the whole cavalry shows up. And not about 40 minutes after, Mexican federal police, military, they show up, and a Mexican federal police helicopter shows up and lands right there on Highway 57. They get us out of the vehicle. I get my backpack. I throw everything in my backpack. They pull me into the helicopter, and I tell them, you know, I'm not leaving without Jaime. Mm-hmm. And one of the police officers asked me, is your partner dead? And I said, you go bring him now. Mm-hmm. I was very, very upset and going through a lot of emotion there. And eventually they do bring him. They put him in the helicopter with me. And it's about an 8-minute flight over to the nearest hospital in the state of and city of San Luis Potosí. And that's really when the fear set in for me. Mm-hmm. That's really the panic. And I was petrified at going to the hospital, because I knew, you know, I've worked many cases where these guys go and finish off people at hospitals in Mexico.
Yeah.
I for sure, I thought, okay, this is it. They're really going to come over here and finish me off. I was very concerned and very, very, very upset. And I kept on telling the Mexican federal police commander to please send some help. And, you know, they were sending people from Mexico City, which is
hours away.
So obviously people started flying in, and mm-hmm. the federal police in Mexico has their academy in that city. So eventually their I guess SWAT team showed up, and I remember as soon as they put me got into the hospital, they separated Jaime to another surgery room. They put me in another room, and the hospital initially didn't know that we were Americans. Mm-hmm. They kind of assumed we were Mexican federal police. Mm-hmm. And they were treating us and taking real good care of us. But I never told them who I was, not until after the federal police showed up. And
it was smart. It was a smart decision.
Yeah, I didn't trust anyone at that point.
You didn't have any kind of identification on you or identification. You said something. It was in the Suburban, right?
It was all in my backpack. Yeah. And my backpack never left my sight after that, right next to me in my bed. And it was my diplomatic pouch. And initially they're like, "What do you want? We're gonna put this backpack." And I said, "Don't you dare touch that backpack. That's staying right here." I had my guns in there. And I had my ID. So eventually we the SWAT team guys walks in. "You're Victor Avila. You're secure now. We have the whole hospital surrounded." And then I tell the staff, you know, "My name is Victor Avila. I'm a U.S. federal agent, blah, blah." It kind of, you could tell the atmosphere in the hospital kind of changed. They had an international incident in their hands now. And it had never happened. The last agent killed in the line of duty in Mexico was DEA agent Enrique Camarena in 1985. And it hadn't happened since then. And it was always kind of the unwritten rule of the cartels not to attack U.S. federal agents because they know the wrath that it brings.
It
didn't matter to us at the cartels. They knew we were Americans. They corroborated that. I never had a scumbag or a lowlife or these evil guys ever in my career corroborate my testimony, but they did. They testified that they heard me very clearly that we were Americans. So they had the opportunity to not attack and just leave. But they decided not to.
It's just, and then unfortunately, Jaime passed away.
Yes, the doctor comes in while I'm getting treated on. He comes in and says, "I wanted to let you know that your partner has expired."
Jeez.
And I just told him to please treat him with dignity and respect. Mm-hmm. And eventually, the first U.S. personnel, the first agent to show up, about 3.5-4 hours later, got to be in there and kind of overlooked the whole thing. And I got moved to a different floor. And then all the U.S. personnel showed up, you know, FBI, DEA, Secret Service, some of my supervisors. And about later in the middle of the night, they transferred me out of there in a DEA plane to Ben Taub Hospital in Houston. And so they checked me out there in Houston. And I'm trying to make contact with my family. My family has to be extracted from Mexico at that point because there's a threat, not just to me, but now there's a threat to my family because the information of where I lived was on in the suburban in my GPS. They had my home address. They're listening to all this chatter, and they tell my wife, they send agents to my apartment. They tell my wife, you know, "We got to go." So she gets a bag, packs stuff in there, throws it in there, and they take her and my kids to a hotel in Mexico City, secured by Mexican federal police and U.S. personnel. And at this point, I'm talking to them on the phone, and the next day after that, we reunite in El Paso. They get flown in, they get taken out of traumatic effect for my kids.
Of course,
how they got taken out, you know, all the way down to the floorboards covered by blankets in these Suburbans, escorted by, I don't know, 80 or so police officers, and taken to not the airport in Mexico City, but the airport in Toluca, which is the northern part of Mexico City. And, you know, they finally get on a CBP plane to El Paso, and I make contact with them almost 2 days later.
How did these murderers, these thugs, how did they eventually get caught, Victor?
They did a great job in Mexico. I actually knew the Mexican Attorney General personally, and I knew a couple of high level government officials there, and I would like to think that it played a little bit of a role because I got phone calls from them, and they couldn't believe this had happened to me. But there was a great coordination between the Mexican federal police and U.S. personnel, because the ICE agents and DEA and FBI agents were heavily involved as well. And they found these guys. There was 8 of them, by the way. One of them was presumed dead, and 7 of them were extradited to the U.S. and prosecuted.
Now, I know 2 of them got back-to-back life sentences, correct?
Yes,
and the other ones, it's disgraceful that they got 12 years, I think. What was it?
It is completely disappointing. We were in D.C. all last year for the trial in the summer, and then we returned in November for the sentencing hearing. The sentencing hearing was it's just basically a joke and a slap in the face to the Zapata family and my family. Mm-hmm. We pleaded with that judge, and I'm very familiar with the system. I worked in the U.S. courts. I know how it works.
Sure.
But these guys were all looking at life, whether they pled guilty or not. The other two, the two that got the life sentences didn't talk, didn't say a word. And so they just went to trial, and they were found guilty by a jury and got sentenced to consecutive life sentences. The other five pled guilty and made this deal with the government that to this day, I don't know what that deal meant. You know, they didn't give up Chapo. Mm-hmm. They didn't give up anything that I personally as an agent would think it was substantial for them to get such a departure from a life sentence, because they still were looking at a life sentence. And they have to depart because the guidelines actually called for a life sentence. And you're right, the lowest one was 12 years and the highest sentence I think was 32. That's it. They killed a U.S. federal agent in the line of duty in Mexico.
Yeah.
And one of them, the one that got 12 years, has already been in the country for 4 and plus the credit. He'll be out in a couple of years. Jeez. And you think, well, they'll be deported. Well, we'll wait and see. But
when I started researching your story, Victor, I because you left, by the way, you left, you retired because of you were betrayed. You know, I mean, and my understanding is after this incident, you started doing some digging to find out what happened, and people started turning their back on you.
Completely. It's a complete and utter failure from my government.
You had You had to leave a job that you fought for all your life and you loved.
Oh, Patrick, I struggled with that. The first couple of years, I really had a hard time. You know, I suffer from PTSD and other issues, mm-hmm. but that's one of the biggest things that I really suffered was the loyalty, you know. Mm-hmm. I was a loyal employee. I was a hardworking employee. I loved my job, mm-hmm. and I served with pride, and I didn't get any of that back from the government and my agency. It was complete failure on their part. And they, you know, my medical retirement was, it was because I pursued that. It's not because they offered it to me. It's not because they said, Victor, we're going to take care of you and put you here. And you know, there you go. Because they do it for many other employees. I know what they can do. And there was 1,000 things that I could have done for this agency and the Department of Homeland Security. But none of those were ever offered to me. Mm-hmm. So I had to pursue this. And in May of 2015, I retired, medically retired. But still, all the questions are still unanswered. And yeah. And now we started looking at other aspects of the investigation, like the weapons used, you know?
Yeah, because you're probably going to talk about this, but they came from the United States.
That's right. This is there's another gun walking operation, just like Fast and Furious.
Exactly.
It's actually tied to Fast and Furious. As we all know, it started in Arizona. And this gun walking operation is out of Dallas, Texas. And these individuals had been identified by ATF way before. They knew who they were. They allowed them to continue to purchase these AK-47s and send them south. We had obtained video. A reporter from Sky News in the UK did a great job in a documentary, and your listeners can look it up on YouTube. It's called Agent Down. It's about a 40-minute documentary. It's really good. It really explains all that. And these guys continued to traffic these arms south. But as you know, there's no tracking of these weapons. Once they hit Mexico, they were gone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the first one in Fast and Furious, the attention came when the murder of Agent Brian Terry occurred.
Yeah, that happened in 2010, right?
Yeah, okay. just 2 months before, about yeah. 2-3 months before.
So there's a link there.
Absolutely. Oh, there's a link.
There's a link there.
Well, you know, the Fast and Furious model was they wanted to do this throughout the whole U.S. They wanted ATF to do this. And I worked in Mexico, and everything that we did in Mexico was through the host government. We had no authority on our own to be there. We had no investigative authority. Mm-hmm. Everything had to be done through them. And so the first thing in my question was, when did ATF contact the Mexican federal government to do a controlled delivery, let's say, of these weapons? And let's see, on the other side, we let them go in from the U.S. Still very risky, but now at least you have the host government following them into Mexico, but that was never even the case. These weapons went and has killed, they have killed thousands of people. Mm-hmm. These organized, these cartels, these weapons have killed thousands of people and two U.S. federal agents. There was two weapons that were recovered at our scene that were bought in the U.S. And trafficked through a gunwalking operation supervised by the U.S. government.
Yeah. And when you start asking questions, your partner is dead now. There needs to be justice for, or there should be justice for him, for Jaime and his family, and for you. When you start asking questions, I think President Obama was the president at the time. We talked about this off the air, Victor, and he claimed that it was executive privilege, that he was going to give up this information, or his administration said that, correct?
That's very true, Patrick. And to this day, that privilege and that protection is still there. And my fight is to have this administration hopefully lift that order and allow us to look at those documents. Now, there was an order by, believe it or not, this past March by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, saying that Jeff Sessions and the Department of Justice had filed a lawsuit, and apparently they won this lawsuit, and they said back in March, okay, we're going to get access to these records. So I talk a lot to the Terry family and to Brian Terry's brother, Kent, and we talk and like we get excited. Okay, we're going to finally get to see some of these documents. Well, we don't know where they're at. Mm-hmm. They said they released them, but they're not released. All the FOIA requests that my lawyers have requested of ICE, of DHS, of ATF have all either been denied or ignored altogether. All of them. We can't get someone to answer. Now, I've gotten our federal, even ordered through a federal district judge. They have provided me with many, many copies of media outlets, news reports, newspaper articles, public information. And that's kind of the way they get around it. The latest one is State Department. They gave me back the original complaint that I filed with the government. They give it back to me. I have it in my computer right here. Mm-hmm. So that's what they do. You know, they give you these documents that mean nothing.
Yeah, it's just the stonewalling and round, round and round. And
yeah, seven and a half years later.
I just hope that and you're a fighter, Victor. I know you are. I mean, I can tell that you're a fighter. And obviously what you've been through, don't give up the fight. And I hope you never do. And I hope the Trump administration does the right thing and they release this information. Because not only for you, but for Jaime's family too.
Absolutely. You know? I mean, one of the reasons I strongly believe that I'm here and I survived and it's totally a miracle and God didn't want to take me that day.
No.
But I have a duty, and one of those duties is to get to the truth and get answers. And you're absolutely right. I do this not just for me, but for the Zapata family as well.
Well, Victor Avila, thank you so much, sir. For coming on the show. If there's anything we can do for you, please reach out to me. You have my contact information, Victor, obviously. If people want to find you and read about your story, it's an amazing story. You continue to be amazing. Where can they find you, sir?
The only social media I have out right now is Twitter, and they can find me at Vic Survivor, V-I-C, Survivor 11.
And there's, like Victor said, for the listeners out there, his story is all over the internet. Please take a look at it. And Victor, thank you so much for being here, sir.
Thank you, Patrick, for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right, brother.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at @Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns. We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.